Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
The truth is the most convincing story that maps onto reality, and that's why the central narrative is falling apart.
Right now in the United States, people should not be walking around with masks.
Fiction that it is. We are Americans.
While elections are sometimes messy, this was a secure election.
The founders began the fight for human liberty and self-governance, and it's up to us to finish the job.
I tell you what, we are in a truth emergency right now.
This is the end game.
It's Friday, April 12th, 2024, the 1178th day of dystopia. I'm your moderator, Chris Paul. Let's be reasonable. A warm welcome and hello to all of you listening to the podcast on the day of its release. The only way to do that is by becoming a paid subscriber at imyourmoderator.substack.com. You can do so for as little as $50 a year or $5 a month, and in doing so, you will be supporting me, the work I do, and this show as it expands. And if you can't or you simply don't want to, continue listening to the podcast for free a couple days later on a wide variety of podcast platforms and, of course, Rumble. All I ask is that you share it with your friends. You can find the links to the podcast, the writing, the social media, and the merch site by visiting linktree.com/imyourmoderator. So all week, we have been hearing about FISA renewal. We have to meet these deadlines. FISA must be renewed. The Congress has to act. And they're also telling us they have to act on Ukraine spending as well. There are all these things that Congress must act on, despite the fact that the Congress is illegitimate. Joe Biden is an illegitimate president, and the American people actually don't want the Congress to act on these things. We don't need the Congress to act to keep those things going because the people don't want them. It's strange, isn't it, that it's framed for us as though we need the Congress to do these things because somehow that's going to provide some sort of benefit to us? What is the benefit? And they'll just tell us it's about national security. We need to fight them over there so we don't have to fight them over here. We need to fund these fake foreign proxy wars, and of course give the government the ability to spy on us whenever and wherever they want. Otherwise, the fact that they spy on us all the time anyway might become illegal. And so we might as well start there. In fact, Let's go directly to the text of the Fourth Amendment. The Fourth Amendment reads, "The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue, but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized." And that is part of what's at issue with this FISA discussion. Edward Snowden highlighted the fact that the illegitimate Biden regime believes the Fourth Amendment doesn't matter, just as they believe the rest of the Constitution obviously doesn't matter. It would be better for us to accept that we are in a post-constitutional society right now. We are being governed by an illegitimate government that operates well beyond the consent of the governed. That fact would be immediately recognizable to virtually everybody. We are in a dictatorship. This is a banana republic. But for the fact that we are told we have elections in this country, and therefore this form of government is what the people decided. The Constitution isn't even in play any longer, at least not from the perspective of the people who exert control over our society. Snowden highlighted a memo released by the illegitimate Biden administration that was initially publicized by Jordan Carney of Politico. Snowden wrote, "Whoa, the White House is calling the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution a threat to national security. This is a real memo sent out today. The yellow highlighted sections just translate the euphemism, the Biggs Amendment, to plain language, the Biggs warrant requirement." And what Snowden did was kind of edit the original document to remove the Orwellian doublespeak. Let's go to the original document. This is what the illegitimate regime put out. "The Biggs Amendment is a threat to national security. The Biggs Amendment would eviscerate the value of Section 702. So Snowden's version eliminates the words "the Biggs Amendment" and replaces them with "the warrant requirement," which is directly from the Constitution's Fourth Amendment. He is making the point that the illegitimate administration is arguing that the Constitution's Fourth Amendment itself is what's presenting the threat to national security. It's an insane argument that in itself would be violating the oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States of America if indeed any of these illegitimate actors actually had oaths. I was watching a video by the Reese Report on Rumble. They pointed to a 1963 document presented in the House of Representatives of 45 declared goals to move the country toward communism, the communist takeover of America. Number 13 on that list was do away with all loyalty oaths. And it seems as though that goal has been achieved at this point. The idea that a presidential administration would suggest that a constitutional amendment is itself a threat to national security, and that the claim of a threat to national security should allow them to override the Bill of Rights, is a direct violation of the oath they are expected to have taken. The fact that they are doing this on behalf of a global regime looking to subvert and subsume the United States of America into a one-world global order should provide yet another illustration of just how treasonous these people are. But let's go through this memo. "This extreme amendment would impose dangerous limits on the ability to review critical intelligence on key threats, including terrorist threats to the homeland, fentanyl supply chains bringing deadly drugs into American communities, Russian war crimes, and hostile governments' recruitment of spies. The amendment bars U.S. officials from querying lawfully collected Section 702 data to find communications of an American, except in extraordinarily limited and unworkable exceptions." Good. While Section 702 is focused exclusively on foreigners overseas, this prohibition would block the intelligence community to identifying vital intelligence it has already collected where foreign 702 targets communicate with or about an American. So basically, they're already getting this information, and they're already using this information. They just want it to be legal. You know, just in case they end up out of power and someone actually wants to hold them accountable. This will prevent U.S. officials from quickly examining critical communications already in the government's lawful possession, raising the unacceptable risk that the government might not respond to a developing threat until it is too late or at all. Well, when has the government in recent history responded to a developing threat in any effective way that would then provide a benefit to the American people? I cannot think of any examples of that. And we are just then supposed to assume that there are examples, they just can't be shared with us because it's classified. It's a matter of national security, you see? You're just going to have to trust them. You're just going to have to trust your elected representatives. Those people serving beyond the bounds of the oaths they may not have taken and serving on the authority of elections they know were rigged, but trust them to violate your privacy. It's for a good cause. Queries of Section 702, including U.S. person queries, are essential to identify and disrupt threats to our national security and to protect victims. The FBI's ability to quickly query Section 702 information has enabled investigators to. So now we're going to get the consequentialist viewpoint. If we didn't have this power, we wouldn't have been able to already help you in these important ways. So let's see what we've won. Prevent a potentially imminent strike by a terrorist in the homeland who had the means to conduct an attack and had researched and identified specific sites. Well, I mean, if it's that important, we might as well make a law that allows our government to torture us whenever they want to. I mean, that right there is a justification for anything, absolutely anything. If you don't give us this power, there's going to be a terrorist attack. Now, just consider for a second that maybe these people aren't on your side and they are saying you need to allow us to do this thing or there is going to be a terrorist attack. That does not sound like they are attempting to defend you and need your help. That sounds like they are threatening you. And of course they are. But let's keep going. Disrupt an ongoing assassination and kidnapping plot targeting a dissident in the United States. What? Mitigate a cyber breach by China-based hackers against U.S. critical infrastructure. Oh yeah, you guys crushed it on that container ship that was turned into a remote-controlled drone capable of taking down a bridge. But oh wait, our election infrastructure is also critical infrastructure. Are you saying that China-based hackers could have breached that? Well, that can't be true. It was the safest and most secure election of all time. By the way, are China-based hackers Chinese or are those global regime hackers and the hack was based in China somewhere? You always have to remember their conflation of the good twin and evil twin within a certain geography. That is a crazy way to present this scenario, but they know this paradigm has already been battered into the heads of everyone who was educated in the United States. So our response is, ooh, scary, China. Back to the memo. Under the Biggs Amendment, the FBI would have been unable to gain access to the critical information necessary to take these actions in time to protect the country. Okay. The exceptions to the amendment's query ban are alarmingly narrow and unworkable. The warrant exception allows a query if, beforehand, the executive branch has obtained a court order based on probable cause. But the executive branch almost never can meet that standard at the earliest stages of an investigation when queries are most critical. Also, it would be impossible to use these techniques against the executive branch if you had to check with them first. It makes deep state coups a lot more difficult. The exigent circumstances exception for imminent threats of death and serious bodily harm would almost never be satisfied, even in the face of a terrorist threat. Queries are often run to determine if an emergency exists in the first place. Without viewing the results of a query, an analyst would not know whether the threat meets the statutory exception. So you see, they need this power in order to thwart the threats. And they also need this power to know whether or not there are threats, which means they also need this power in the absence of threats, because the warrant requirement is a threat to national security. The consent exception is not practical in national security investigations. It is often impossible to know in advance whether a person is a victim or perpetrator of malicious activity, and there is often not sufficient time to obtain consent from a private party. This would be a reckless policy choice that is contrary to the key lessons of 9/11 and not grounded in any constitutional requirement or statute. So there have essentially been three positions on this FISA debate this week. These are generalizations, of course, but the options were to renew FISA with the warrants, without the warrants, or just let the thing sunset. There was a big public push this week by various members of the House GOP conference. They were all writing "get a warrant, hashtag FISA." Not sure if that was virtue signaling or what. Donald Trump posted on Truth Social that the bill should be killed. Some of those people who had been saying get the warrant went along to Trump's position. And then we heard about how Mike Johnson had lost control of his conference. Mike Johnson, who was reported to have always been very MAGA aligned, used to be against FISA. He has since switched positions. And here he is explaining that last night in the halls of Congress.
Abuses of the FBI, the terrible abuses over and over and over, the hundreds of thousands of abuses. And then when I became speaker, I went to the SCIF and got the confidential briefing from sort of the other perspective on that to understand the necessity of Section 702 of FISA and how important it is for national security. And it gave me a different perspective. So I encourage all the members to go to the classified briefing and hear all that and see it so they can evaluate the situation for themselves. And I think some opinions have changed both ways, but that's part of the process. You got to be fully informed.
Have you been
So you see, if you had been in a SCIF in that classified briefing, you would understand why all of this is so important. And without that, it really doesn't make sense, especially in light of all of the abuses of FISA over the years. But let's go step by step through the various votes today. This is from this morning in the New York Times. The headline is "Surveillance Bill Clears Key Hurdle in House, Putting It Back on Track." The House took a critical first step on Friday toward reauthorizing a law extending an expiring warrantless surveillance law that national security officials say is crucial to fighting terrorism, voting to take it up 2 days after a previous attempt to pass it collapsed. Grasping to salvage the measure before the law expires next week, Speaker Mike Johnson put forward a shorter extension, 2 years instead of five, in a move that appeared to win over hard right Republicans who blocked the bill earlier this week. On a party line vote of 213 to 208, the House agreed to take up the new version of the legislation, which would extend a section of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, known as Section 702. That cleared the way for a debate Friday on proposed changes to the bill before a final vote on passage. The preliminary vote on Friday suggested that the measure was back on track after former President Donald J. Trump implored lawmakers this week to kill FISA, complaining that government officials had used it to spy on him. Should it pass the House, the Senate would still have to clear it, sending it to President Biden for his signature. Mr. Johnson's 2-year version of the bill was an attempt to mollify hard-right Republicans who believe Mr. Trump would be president once again the next time the law expired. All 19 of them who voted to block the measure on Wednesday switched their positions on Friday to allow it to go forward. So we are told that is the major concession. It is now only extended for 2 years rather than five. That 2 years would mean it comes up again while Trump is president in his next term. That was the justification for these Republican members to move this process forward rather than killing it. Now, again, I'm of the mind that these people are illegitimate. Joe Biden does not have the power to sign something into law in any way that'll pass muster whatsoever once his obvious illegitimacy becomes the focus. I think that these things are playing out as they're going to play out along a certain timeline. And if you understand that, then we have to understand what they are trying to create in the public consciousness. What are these various narratives for? What are Trump's moves within the narrative meant to accomplish? And as I suggested yesterday, I think that this is a sifting process. He is smoking people out. And I believe that that's what he was doing when he asked for this to be killed on Wednesday. So we had the first vote this morning. A few hours later, we have the second. This is the Washington Examiner. House shoots down warrant requirement for surveillance searches in dramatic tie vote. So we went from the bill is dead to just kidding, it's back and there will be no warrant requirement. The House rejected a controversial proposal to prohibit warrantless surveillance searches by the federal government, dealing a blow to hardline Republicans who pushed to have the proposal included in the broader national surveillance law that is set to expire next week. The amendment narrowly failed in a 212-212 vote on Friday, falling short of the majority threshold needed to include it in the surveillance law. The vote is a loss for hard-right lawmakers who fought to have the amendment in the reauthorization of Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, threatening to shoot down the surveillance law altogether if it was not included. The narrow vote came down to the wire on Friday, with members scrambling on the floor to ensure their votes were counted. Shortly before the vote was passed, lawmakers were seen yelling on the floor to keep the vote open as long as possible. Oh, a dramatic tie vote. The amendment proposed by Representative Andy Biggs of Arizona would have required the federal government to obtain a warrant before executing data searches on U.S. communications in the FISA 702 database. The measure includes exceptions for, quote, imminent threats to life or bodily harm, consent searches, or known cybersecurity threat signatures. The article also notes the exclusion of the amendment makes the passage of the FISA reauthorization more likely, as Democrats would have likely opposed the underlying legislation if it included the warrant requirements. Even if it was included and managed to pass the House and Senate, the White House came out in opposition to the amendment on Thursday night, making it unclear whether President Joe Biden would have signed it into law. So our uniparty Congress decided that this bill must pass, but it couldn't pass with the warrant requirement, and they couldn't just let it die. So they decided that the best thing to do was extend it without the warrant requirements. This is NBC News. House votes to renew FISA spying tool after earlier Republican revolt. You see, they were revolting in principle, but now they're complying out of necessity and complicity, having already branded themselves people who would oppose it out of principle. They are having their principles and violating them too. So here we are with the third vote coming less than an hour after the second. The House voted to renew a powerful surveillance program on Friday, 2 days after a band of 19 conservative privacy hawks revolted against Republican leadership and blocked the legislation on the floor when their demands were not met. The vote was 273 to 147 and was overwhelmingly bipartisan, with both Republicans and Democrats voting in favor of the legislation. Of those who supported the legislation, 126 were Republicans and 147 Democrats. It followed a dramatic vote to narrowly reject an amendment that would have required a warrant for surveillance in more situations. Earlier Friday, the conservative rebels ended their blockade and allowed the bill to move forward after striking a deal with Speaker Mike Johnson and his team. Under the agreement, the reauthorization period of the spy powers, known as Section 702 of FISA, would be cut to 2 years from the original proposed 5 years. Republicans said that would give former President Donald Trump, who said this week he wants to kill FISA, a chance to make his mark on the law if he wins back the White House. "We just bought President Trump an at-bat," said Representative Matt Gaetz, a top Trump ally and one of the 19 rebels. The previous version of this bill would have kicked reauthorization beyond the Trump presidency. Now President Trump gets an at-bat to fix the system that victimized him more than any other American. And I generally like Matt Gaetz a lot. I don't understand that logic. How about just making sure that FISA couldn't be used to spy on Donald Trump for those 2 years until he gets his at-bat? Now, Mike Johnson on Wednesday was described by the media to have lost control of the conference. These 19 rebels had overridden the will of Mike Johnson and embarrassed him before the nation. And today, Mike Johnson voted against the Biggs Amendment. He was the final vote creating that tie that allowed this process to proceed. MTG is out there saying that this provides more justification for her motion to vacate. But if that's true, what is she waiting for? Why not just bring it? And so there have been some pretty heated reactions. Representative Andrew Clyde said on X, formerly Twitter, 212 members of Congress voted to continue letting the FBI illegally spy on Americans without warrants. Senator Mike Lee said an amendment requiring the FBI to get a warrant before searching Americans' private communications under FISA 702 just failed in the House on a tie vote of 212 to 212. Literally every member of the House who opposed that amendment made the difference between failure and passage. And he's just making the point that any one of those people could have changed the outcome on that amendment. But that, I think, is probably a bit silly. These things are strategized and well planned out. It's not like they're all just happening in real time. Everyone just walking up and voting their conscience. That's not how it works. Kash Patel wrote, "Did a single person in Congress ask Ray why his FBI illegally used FISA 702 against Americans 278,000 times? Targeted at political donors in January 6th. Anyone in Congress have any desire to ask the necessary questions for actual accountability and reform instead of bickering over meaningless headlines?" Cash also highlighted this week a joint statement from him and Richard Grenell last December, saying, "We know better than most people just how the intelligence community has been allowed to abuse the system to punish their political enemies. We have called for the reform of FISA 702 to help install better guardrails on those who seek to abuse their authority. As Congress deliberates the extension of this foreign intelligence tool, we must ask why Chris Wray and his FBI have been allowed to abuse that very surveillance privilege and broken the law over 274,000 times to illegally surveil Americans. Remember, the F in FISA is foreign. Absent a dramatic reform of FISA 702, we call upon Congress to let it lapse. Better to have no authority for 7 days or so than another 365 days of spying on Trump and his supporters." And the whole discussion really is crazy. If they want powers that violate the plain text of the Bill of Rights, then they should argue to the American public for however long it takes that that power is necessary to keep our country safe and sovereign. And if they can't convince the country of that, to the extent that the country is then willing to support a constitutional amendment changing the Bill of Rights, then you're not allowed to do it. We cannot keep giving away our rights every time they say that something bad will happen if we don't. We are not even trading our liberty for additional security at this point. We are giving our liberty away every time they tell us that someone is presenting a threat. They are the threat. They're the ones funding rogue regimes. They're the ones funding terrorist organizations. They're the ones funding cartels and funding gangs and making sure criminals can't be put away. They're the ones arming gangs and supplying those gangs with drugs. They're the ones creating the crime problem around the country. And they're the ones pushing to defund the police while empowering their federal police forces. So not only are they not keeping us safe, they're presenting the threats and then telling us on the basis of those threats that we must give up our liberty. Now, apparently, this process isn't over, and Ana Paulina Luna, who most of us assume is on the right side of things, while also potentially existing as a human information operation, is attempting to slow down this process, if not thwart it, with some procedural moves. This is Fox News' Chad Pergram.
On Capitol Hill with the latest. So now it heads to the Senate, Chad?
Yes, but with a caveat, an asterisk. There is another procedural hurdle, something that's pretty rare, and we're just breaking this down right now, that they're going to have to go through. You're absolutely right. They passed the bill 273 to 147 here, but there was a motion made by Ana Paulina Luna, Republican from Florida, that's going to hold this up, and there's going to have to be another vote to kind of discharge this to get this over to the Senate. We don't see this very often. All that is a delaying tactic, but they have passed the bill. The bill is, in fact, passed, but they can't send it across to the Senate. Keep in mind that there is a deadline here in about a week and a half where the Senate has to sync up with the House, or the House has to align with the Senate to make sure that these programs don't go dark. But they have passed the bill today, 2-year reauthorization through 2026. John?
All right, so Kelly Ferris says that they have to take another vote next week on a motion to table on the motion to reconsider. Can you put that in English for us?
Reconsider is basically saying we're going to vote again, okay? And what you can do to euthanize that, to terminate that, is table it. That kills it. So we don't see that very often where somebody demands a roll call vote on that very arcane piece of parliamentary procedure. But basically, you hear this at the end of every roll call vote where they move to reconsider and then somebody says they move to table and that's it. That didn't happen today. And that's the holdup that would delay it getting to the Senate, John.
So from that, I would assume that we are going to get one more news cycle out of this FISA story next week. And I know that people are focused on the outcomes of these debates and who votes for what, but I really sincerely don't think that makes a whole lot of sense when you consider the size and scope of the problems we're dealing with and the fact that all of this is illegitimate. Focus on the narrative warfare here and understand that as it goes through this process and they have to do news cycle after news cycle about this thing that the American people definitely do not want, each time that plays out and the Uniparty gets its way very publicly, the narrative damage is increased. The more that happens, the more Donald Trump looks like the only possible and acceptable way forward, and that's becoming true even to Democrats. And not to go too deep into this, but here is some proof of that. This is from Wednesday at RasmussenReports.com. This is Rasmussen, the polling company. Yes, it's an invasion, voters say, of border crisis. Nearly 2/3 of Americans believe the situation along the Mexican border should be called an invasion. The latest Rasmussen Reports national telephone and online survey finds that 64% of likely U.S. voters believe it is accurate to describe the current situation with migrants at the border with Mexico as an invasion of the United States, including 42% who say such a description is very accurate. They also reported this week that their polling has found that a majority of Republicans and a majority of independents think that the Biden administration is, quote, encouraging so much illegal immigration, end quote, because they want them to become voters and create a permanent majority for Democrats. Over one third of Democrats agree with that statement. And if self-identified Democrats were honest, and I know that that's probably not possible, it's actually well above the 36% who say they agree. It used to be just common discussion on uniparty left cable news that the Democrats would have a permanent majority because of immigration. You got to remember, we're talking about people who don't believe illegal immigration should be illegal. Standard issue villagers on the uniparty left think it is their act of personal charity to allow anyone who wants to come here to be welcomed into America and then given resources and voting rights. They genuinely believe that they are solving historic racism and white supremacy. And yes, that is absolutely retarded to the point where it's hard for anyone to believe that someone else could believe such things, but I promise you that they do. They genuinely believe they are solving racism by pushing for open borders, and they have also been convinced that crime is the product of racism. So they can't hold illegal aliens accountable for crime if they are black or brown. They're also convinced that illegal aliens are here to do jobs that Americans don't want to do and wouldn't do. So therefore, all the illegal aliens are necessary, and the rest of the belief system just represents the moral necessities that follow from those economic necessities. Now, there's been a lot of Ukraine news over the last week, so I want to hit some of that. But yesterday, in the context of the Venezuela and Guyana discussion, we talked a bit about energy resources and economic sanctions. And last night, we get this headline from Zero Hedge. In latest humiliation for Biden administration, Russian oil is trading above the G7 price cap everywhere. Back in late 2022, when Western democracies bombastically unveiled theatrical sanctions against Putin, capping the price at which imports of Russian oil were permitted to go no higher than $60, we said that this was one of the biggest farces in modern history, not only because it was an optical play that was made entirely for public consumption, as nobody in the West actually wanted to curtail Russian oil exports, as the outcome would be a devastating surge of inflation, as Biden now realizes, but also because there was no enforcement mechanism to cap the price at $60 and no more. And how about that? Another international decision goes totally ignored by those countries who those new standards are meant to control. If everybody simply ignores the regime, their governing bodies, and their decrees, all those bodies just vanish because there's no enforcement mechanism. If they cannot send the U.S. military wherever they want at any time they want, the whole jig is up. Back to Zero Hedge. We were right again, and today Bloomberg reports that, quote, Russian oil is trading far in excess of a Group of Seven price cap that's supposed to deprive Moscow of revenue for its war in Ukraine, suggesting significant non-compliance with the measure, end quote, which anyone with half a working brain would have expected to happen, which of course excludes virtually all Democratic bureaucrats who implemented this idiotic sanction, which only ended up making the vital oil traders billionaires. And so think about what's going on here. There are two methods of control. Actual force, the threat of physical kinetic violence, and the economic manipulations. And neither of those things are working anymore because the global regime is a paper tiger and the world's superpowers are opting out of the global regime's fiat banking system and their fiat currency, currently branded the US dollar. And you can apply that exact same principle to our lives as the men and women of the United States of America. What are the control mechanisms? The control mechanism, first and foremost, is the global regime's fiat dollar. The only other control mechanism is the threat of force and violence. You will have your property taken away from you. You might have your liberty taken away from you, and you may have to endure physical pain and suffering. If the American Uniparty and its minions are unable to use economic manipulation and the threat of state violence against the people, there are no other control mechanisms. Now, there's not currently a great way to avoid the threat of state violence, but you can begin to opt out of the regime fiat system and the fact that if all your money is in regime fiat bucks, they're able to change how much money you have whenever they want. And the truth is, they do it all the time. They say, oh, you've got $1,000? Well, we're going to change the value of that so you can only buy $800 worth of stuff with this money that you have earned and saved. And they can do that whenever they want. So how are you going to get ahead? How are you going to rise to the next economic class? How are you going to pursue the American dream? You're not going to, because they're going to change how much your money's worth. People who remain in their system will be subject to that influence and that power whenever they decide to wield it. That is why so many of us believe that opting out and fortifying yourself with a currency that cannot, at least in the future, be manipulated is the way to go. And by the way, if you are on that path, partner.river.com/reasonable is a great and very easy way to begin that process. But let's move to the Russia-Ukraine conflict. This is the American Conservative from Tuesday. The Biden administration just admitted it has massively undercounted Ukraine aid. One of the worst-kept secrets in Washington is no one actually knows just how much money the United States has spent in support of Ukraine. Over the past year, however, conservatives in Congress have been pushing President Joe Biden and his administration for the real number, and they're finally getting some answers. In a letter sent to the Office of Management and Budget Director Shalanda Young on Tuesday, Senator J.D. Vance of Ohio and Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia, along with Senators Roger Marshall, Rand Paul, Mike Lee, and 12 other members of Congress, chronicled the immense difficulty Congress has had in getting what should be readily available information from the Biden administration. When Vance and other conservatives in Congress started pressing the Biden administration to provide the real cost of the Ukraine war in January 2023, the lawmakers estimated the U.S. had spent a minimum of $114 billion. Now, with added information from the OMB, Vance and company estimate the current total of Ukraine aid to at least $125 billion, $14 billion over what the OMB had previously claimed. That's not all. Conservatives believe the Biden administration could give Ukraine around another $4 billion in the form of weapons transfers from U.S. stockpiles under the presidential drawdown authority. That would bring the total amount the U.S. could give to Ukraine to $129 billion. On Wednesday, we had this headline from Fox News. U.S. sends seized Iranian weapons to Ukraine. Greenlights $138 million in Hawk missile support systems. The stalled $60 billion military aid package to Ukraine is not stopping the Biden administration from getting weapons and other military assistance to the war-torn country as it battles back against a Russian invasion. On Tuesday, the State Department approved an emergency $138 million in foreign military sales for Ukraine to provide critical repairs and spare parts for Kyiv's Hawk missile systems, noting Ukraine has an urgent need for maintenance support to keep the missile system running. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said that without support, the U.S. risks Ukraine falling to Russia. Why is that a risk to the U.S.? Ukraine matters, and the outcome of the conflict in Ukraine will have global implications for our national security as well, Austin said during a Capitol Hill hearing on Tuesday. So similarly to the Russian assets that were seized that the U.S. and that the global regime want to distribute to Ukraine and to Israel and to Taiwan. In this case, we have weapons seized from Iran that will be redistributed to Ukraine. And we have a clear policy emerging from the global regime. It is okay for them to steal things with the justification that the things that are being stolen are the property of very, very bad people. And they can then give those things, that money, those weapons, to whoever they decide needs it. It's like Robin Hood, basically. Assuming that Robin Hood was at least as evil as the Sheriff of Nottingham, if not more evil. Politico caused a stir on Tuesday with this headline: Zelensky warns Russia has penetrated U.S. politics, invites Trump to Ukraine. President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine warned in an interview that Russian influence had pierced the American political system and rejected the idea, backed by allies of Donald Trump, that Ukraine could swiftly end the war just by making massive territorial concessions. Now, it's worth noting that Rhino Congressman Mike Turner agrees with Volodymyr Zelensky that Americans have fallen for Russian propaganda, including Republican members of Congress, and that if they were true American patriots, they would support us giving $60 billion more dollars to Ukraine. Now, there's another problem with Politico's article already. They call Volodymyr Zelensky the president of Ukraine, but his term has expired and he canceled elections after banning opposition parties. So if they were describing any other leader, that would be the dictator of a banana republic. It's strange that Volodymyr Zelensky does not get that treatment. I wonder if it has something to do with the fact that if they said he was illegitimate, people might start wondering if they had been lied to about this whole Russia-Ukraine thing. Back to Politico. But Zelensky said Tuesday that he had privately urged Trump through intermediaries to travel to Ukraine and that Trump had expressed interest but had not yet committed to making a trip. Zelensky said he was open to hearing Trump's proposals for the war, while making clear he was highly skeptical. If the deal is that we just give up our territories and that's the idea behind it, then it's a very primitive idea, Zelensky said in an interview with Axel Springer media outlets. Politico is owned by Axel Springer. Zelensky continued, "I need very strong arguments. I don't need a fantastic idea. I need a real idea because people's lives are at stake." So we talked last week about how Donald Trump has met with Viktor Orban. He has met with Mohammed bin Salman. He just had a meeting with David Cameron, who is currently the Foreign Secretary of the UK. And now Volodymyr Zelensky is treating Donald Trump as though he's president or something. Why won't Joe Biden's illegitimate administration arrest Donald Trump for these continued flagrant violations of the Logan Act? Now, this is not the first time that Zelensky has suggested Trump travel to Ukraine. Trump's people turned this invitation down on his behalf, or at least that's what the mainstream media is telling us this week, due to the belief that it would be inappropriate for them to meet, since Donald Trump, of course, is not president and he's not commander in chief. And man, you would think that it's about time after 3.5 years that the other leaders around the world might realize that. Don't they know who's president of the United States of America and that it's Joe Biden? What's going on here? Kremlin press spokesman Dmitry Peskov said in a statement to Newsweek this week regarding Donald Trump's involvement in peace talks, "We have seen reports on this, but so far no initiatives have been announced by Donald Trump. Therefore, it is impossible to make estimates." It's weird that they're not just like, "Donald Trump's not the president, duh. Why would we care what he says?" You would think that the Kremlin press office would listen to Joy Reid. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov made it clear this week that Russia's interests must be taken into account in any sort of peace deal. And he mentioned Zelensky's 10-point peace formula from the fall of 2022 that called for a complete and unconditional withdrawal of Russian forces from all the territories within Ukraine's 1991 borders. That means that Russia would have to give back not only all of the territory of those former Ukrainian republics that are now just part of Russia in the eastern portion of Ukraine, but also Crimea. Absolutely none of that is going to happen. Putin's terms have not changed from the beginning. They wanted to demilitarize and denazify Ukraine, make sure that Ukraine does not join NATO or the EU. And they wanted to secure the independence of all those territories that were the targets and victims of the ethnic civil war being waged by the global West, the Kyiv government with all their Nazi battalions for the last 10 years. None of those demands have changed. And speaking of those Nazi battalions, Nazis in Ukraine used to be a conspiracy theory, but now they are almost completely real. This was Politico.eu on April 3rd. Ukraine embraces far-right Russian bad guy to take the battle to Putin. You got that? A far-right Russian bad guy is going to take the battle to Putin. We're the bad guys, but fighting really evil guys. Wisecracks Denis Kapustin. For now, Ukraine is willing to embrace his form of bad guy. As a Russian militant who led eye-catching paramilitary raids into Russia from Ukrainian territory this year and last, Kyiv sees Kapustin has a role to play as an ally against President Vladimir Putin. Oh, so he's a CIA-trained terrorist. That is basically what they're saying. But there are hazards in holding him too close. German authorities say Kapustin, sometimes known as Denis Nikitin, is, quote, one of the most influential neo-Nazi activists, end quote, on the European continent. And that's a godsend to Russian propagandists who are seeking to whitewash their murderous invasion of Ukraine as an attempt to denazify Kyiv. You got that? They are aligning with a Nazi who they say is Russian, which is a necessity because Russia is where the truly evil people are. So they're aligning with a Nazi out of necessity. He's Russian, so they don't totally claim him. But the fact that they have had to do this is a boon to Russian propagandists because now, finally now, they get to claim that Ukraine is aligned with Nazis, which would justify their claims the entire time that this special military operation is specifically for the purpose of denazifying Ukraine, which we are told, of course, is a conspiracy theory somehow. Think of the good, the bad, and the ugly, adds Kapustin, who leads the Russian Volunteer Corps. You see, very Russian again. The largest of three anti-Kremlin Russian militias fighting for Ukraine. It is amazing the hoops that they are attempting to jump through to make it seem like they haven't been lying nonstop for well over 2 years. Back to Kapustin. Before, you just had good guys and bad guys dressed in black in cowboy movies. And then Clint Eastwood comes along and he's dressed in black and fighting for good. Damn, this leading Nazi in Europe has a great understanding of American cinema. Kapustin is indeed dressed in black for his discussion with Politico in a downtown Kyiv hotel. Though his clothing is free of any neo-Nazi logos or flashes, it's almost like he's not a Nazi when he's hanging out with Politico. That's despite the fact that he runs a far-right apparel line of t-shirts and caps emblazoned with white nationalist and xenophobic imagery, as well as the Nazi symbol 88, the eighth letter of the alphabet, twice being a not-so-subtle code for Heil Hitler. So he's a Nazi, but not really right when he meets Politico, and he's just interested in American cinema, and he's a fashion designer. But Politico is absolutely not attempting to normalize this Nazi, just like they haven't spent the last 2.5 years pretending these Nazis don't fight for Ukraine. And they can't fight for Ukraine because the very real president of Ukraine, the comedic actor Volodymyr Zelensky, well, he's reportedly part Jewish. So you see, it's impossible that Nazis are fighting for Ukraine. And since they are fighting for Ukraine, you have to at least assume that they are the good Nazis, not the bad ones. But let's keep going. I walk a thin line, Kapustin says, disputing the neo-Nazi label and noting, almost teasingly, that he doesn't put swastikas on any of the t-shirts he flogs, as though that proves anything. Oh, Politico, getting a little bold here. Russian state media relish pointing to Kapustin's origins as a far-right football hooligan as it bolsters their pretext for the war. And again, the term far-right here is utterly meaningless when you're talking about a collective race-based ideology. It is only of the left. Moscow's continual attempt to cast their struggle as a rerun of World War II against Nazism rings hollow in reality, however. Not only is Ukraine's president Jewish, but far-right extremist parties have near negligible support in national representative politics. So you see that? Because Volodymyr Zelensky is Jewish, these guys aren't bad Nazis. And because no one who is officially and formally declared to be a Nazi is recognized as holding elected public office, there are no Nazis and they have no influence. It's like with Joe Biden and the fact that he was mentored for decades in politics by a Klan leader and then went on to say, if you don't vote for him, you ain't black. And of course, Joe Biden is an old white Democrat who represents the party of the Klan, the party of Jim Crow. And he coordinates and facilitates a global slave trade on behalf of the global regime. He doesn't actually admit to any of that. Therefore, he is just a truly devout Catholic and a very, very decent family man. If that weren't enough, Moscow's insistence that Ukraine's forces are Nazis overlooks the fact that avowed neo-Nazi groups are fighting for Russia, too. Oh, got it. So in order to deny that there are Ukrainian Nazis, they have suggested that there are also Russian Nazis, which cancels out the Ukrainian Nazis. Now, we're going to have to assume that while these people are running a cover operation for Ukrainian Nazis, that they must be telling the truth about the Russian Nazis. Otherwise, this ploy wouldn't work at all, including the notorious Rusich militia, which happily displays Nazi flashes, advocates racist ideology, and has been accused of battlefield atrocities in Ukraine and Syria, and the white supremacist Russian Imperial Movement, designated a terrorist organization by the United States. So, there you have it. Russia, despite defeating the Nazis in World War II, they are the real Nazis, the real evil people. Therefore, Ukrainian Nazis, led by someone who is reportedly Jewish, those are the good Nazis. In 2022, Germany's BND intelligence service said the Russian military has welcomed neo-Nazi groups in its ranks, rendering, quote, the alleged reason for the war, the so-called denazification of Ukraine, absurd. And if you can't trust German intelligence agencies about who's a Nazi and who isn't, who can you trust? Yet none of that stops the Russians ignoring Nazis in their own ranks and focusing on Kapustin, who goes by the nom de guerre White Rex, just like his clothing label. Kapustin's RVC and two other Ukraine-based anti-Putin paramilitary groups, Freedom of Russia Legion and the newest formation, the Siberian Battalion, are in the news again after launching on March 12th their biggest cross-border raids of the war around Kursk and Belgorod, remaining on Russian soil and fighting for more than 2 weeks. Prior to that, their biggest raid was in May 2023 when they stormed villages and towns in the Belgorod region. Gosh, I guess we better hope that Western intelligence isn't directing the activity of these organizations, or Russia might consider this to be a NATO attack on Russian territory employing the use of Nazi foot soldiers. And NATO would never do that. NATO is definitely not the same global regime element that invaded Russia with Nazis the first time around. That just is not possible. Alexei Baranovsky of the Freedom of Russia Legion claimed at a press conference last week that the latest raids, quote, disrupted the plans of the Russian army and caused significant damage to it. And we are supposed to applaud this because these are the good Nazi terrorist cells, not the bad ones. And you know this because these Nazis are fighting on behalf of their Jewish leaders. Wait, what? Whew. I hope there aren't any Jews reading this Politico article. I mean, this is just blatant anti-Semitism, from what I'm told. The status of these militia groupings in relation to Ukraine's armed forces is murky. Baranovsky claims his group is a, quote, regular unit of the armed forces of Ukraine, end quote, telling Politico at last week's press conference, when we are on the territory of Ukraine, we are servicemen of the Ukrainian army, equal in all rights and duties to all other servicemen of Ukraine. When we go to the territory of Russia, we are no longer Ukrainian servicemen. We are Russian citizens who have taken up arms. Now that sounds like the sort of argument that would really impress the International Court of Justice and no other thinking person in the entire world. The UN would accept that as an explanation, and people who used to have Ukraine flag emojis in their profiles would probably accept that, but that is one of the stupidest things I've ever heard. Some in Ukraine's regular army frown on the tie-up between the militias, especially the RVC, and Ukraine's military intelligence, HUR, arguing it offers the Russians a propaganda opportunity. And for what? Asked an official who sits on Ukraine's National Security and Defense Council, but who asked not to be named in this article, to be able to speak freely. And that makes sense, because if the Kyiv regime found out who this was, they might send Nazis to his house to kill him. But on the other hand, it's possible that Politico is just making this person up to make it seem as though parts of the Kyiv regime are opposed to the use of Nazis. These militias are a sideshow. They can't influence the war's dynamics. Maybe they disrupt a bit behind the lines and are embarrassing for the Kremlin, but that doesn't outweigh the overall propaganda disadvantages of using them, the anonymous official added. You see that? They don't have to take responsibility for these Nazis because they're just simply not very good at their jobs. The whole enterprise is a pet project of Kirillo Budanov, the head of HUR. Isn't that one of the guys that was featured in that New York Times article? Why, yes, he was. That article, by the way, was from February 25th of this year. The headline was "The Spy War: How the CIA Secretly Helps Ukraine Fight Putin." So the CIA trained this guy. Let's go back to Politico. The whole enterprise is a pet project of Kirillo Budanov, the head of HUR. As the cross-border raids unfolded last month, Budanov praised the Russian paramilitaries as good warriors on a national newscast. They've been helping us since the first day. They have fought in many of Ukraine's hottest spots. We were going to try and help them as much as we can, he said. As far as HUR sees it, their enemy's enemy is their friend. According to Andrei Yusov, an HUR spokesman, Ukraine should obviously also assist those Russians who are fighting against the Putin regime to free Russia. He said the militias don't act in Russia on the direct orders of Kyiv, and their actions just go to show, quote, the Kremlin is once again not in control of the situation in Russia, end quote. Maybe so, says Politico, but it depends on how you define under orders. Kapustin says the militias have freedom of action once across the border, but the raids are closely coordinated with the HUR, which provides logistical assistance, vets their operational plans, and arms and pays them. All three militias are formally part of the Ukrainian armed forces enlisted in the International Legion, says Kapustin. We are an official part of the Ukrainian army, but we have serious political ambitions and political agenda to get rid of Putin, he adds. Politico uses most of the rest of the article to let you know who this Kapustin is as a person. They want to give you his origin story so that you know and can relate to why he feels the way he does. This article legitimately exists to normalize this man as the face of Ukrainian Nazis, and then suggest that Russians are Nazis too, therefore it is morally required of you to understand that these Nazis are the good ones because they are helping Ukraine fight a much greater evil. But don't worry, they will never tell you that there are good Nazis under any circumstances, at least, you know, if these Nazis are successful in Ukraine. It's entirely possible that they might have to create more good Nazis in the future. And let's close with this. This is from nationalinterest.org on April 4th, the looming Ukraine debacle. There is indeed a serious risk that, rather than the West teaching Russia a lesson and putting Putin in his place, the opposite may occur. With Ukraine's military situation deteriorating, NATO foreign ministers have gathered in Brussels to develop a long-term plan to deliver the necessary supplies to Kyiv. As NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg put it, Ukrainians are not running out of courage, they are running out of ammunition. Distracted by other matters, America increasingly looks to Europe to coordinate the defense of Ukraine. But other than scrambling for shells and money or unveiling a modest EU defense industry strategy, European leaders do not appear to have the ideas or the means to intervene in a decisive or timely fashion. French President Emmanuel Macron's suggestion that NATO troops may enter Ukraine was supported by Poland and Czechia, but caused some consternation in France itself. More importantly, Germany, the United Kingdom, and the United States still rule out boots on the ground. Instead of a new approach, the old pattern continues. NATO mulls over how to help Ukraine without provoking open war with Russia and fails, in the end, to deliver the kind of decisive assistance needed to turn the course of the war. And again, it is obvious in Russia's view that NATO does not present a real threat. Another established pattern is the repetition of moralistic binary language. The West, quote, cannot let Russia win, end quote. The quote-unquote rules-based order could unravel. Then there is the new domino theory. If Ukraine falls, Russian hordes will flood further west. The personalization of the conflict onto one evil man, Vladimir Putin, continues with the death of Alexei Navalny. It is a Manichaean struggle of good and evil, democracy and authoritarianism, civilization and darkness. There can be, quote, no peace until the tyrant falls, end quote. The Western alliance must not waver in its commitment to Ukraine. And that is, honestly, a pretty well-done summation of the official slogans. What is lacking throughout the discourse is realism. What is the real balance of power between the warring nations, and what can be concluded from 2 years of Russia-NATO hard power competition? Unsurprisingly, Western leaders are reluctant to admit that the dire situation facing Ukraine is related to their own fundamental miscalculations about Russia. Russia's multiple blunders in this war are well known, but what of those made by the Western alliance? And of course, the well-known nature of Russia's blunders cannot and should not be viewed as anything other than the product of Western propaganda. This conflict, to the extent that anything we are being told about it is real, has for the last 25 plus months only deteriorated for Ukraine and only strengthened Russia. There was never any point at which it was headed in any different direction. So the idea that Russia has had serious blunders doesn't really pass muster. About 2 years ago, it became clear that Russia's plan A in Ukraine failed. Putin's initial approach was a sudden movement of troops into Ukraine that, in the best case, could topple Ukraine's government or at least coerce Kyiv into signing a new and less favorable version of the Minsk II agreement. And it would be hard to imagine Vladimir Putin agreeing with that assessment. Russia's Plan A was resisted by the Zelensky government, whose military forces held firm on the outskirts of Kyiv in March 2022. After the collapse of the Istanbul peace negotiations between Kyiv and Moscow in April, Russia shifted to Plan B, waging a grinding war of attrition to exhaust Kyiv's will and capacity to resist while testing the Western alliance's collective ability to sustain Ukraine. And again, the idea that Ukrainian forces kept Russia from taking over Kyiv has always been ridiculous. Russia's Plan B had mixed results in 2022. While Russia won important, if costly, victories in Mariupol and Severodonetsk, Ukraine exploited Russia's lack of manpower to win back territory in the Kharkiv and Kherson regions. However, following a partial military and economic mobilization, Russia turned the corner, defeating Ukraine's offensive in 2023 and taking the upper hand in 2024. And again, all of this is being extremely charitable to the regime's side of this propaganda narrative. As the slow success of Russia's Plan B becomes more apparent, the failure of the West's own Plan A to deal with Russia is now clarified. This plan consisted of sanctions to derail the Russian economy, diplomacy to isolate the Putin regime, and the use of NATO weapons and know-how to inflict serious damage on Russia on the battlefield. The optimal outcome would be Russia's humiliation and withdrawal from Ukraine. But experts assured us that whatever happened, Russia would be seriously weakened and put in its place. Russia's economy was rated as weak and vulnerable to sanctions, given its energy dependency and relatively low GDP score, which is calculated by converting the value of its economy into U.S. dollars. This measure did not account for Russia's strategic industries, resource self-sufficiency, and access to alternative trading partners. Western sanctions on Russia's energy exports backfired, damaging some European economies more than Russia. They also caused a spike in energy prices, ensuring Russia received more than enough revenues to fund its war effort. The hope that most non-Western states would stop trading with Russia also proved unfounded. Russia has increased its trade flows with India, Turkey, and China, while many of Russia's neighbors quietly profit by reselling sanctioned goods to Moscow. The assumption that Russia is a kleptocracy led to personal sanctions on wealthy Russians that were expected to have political side effects. Losing access to their assets and luxuries in the West, Russia's kleptocrats would surely turn on Putin. Instead, the sanctions have largely incentivized them to invest money in their own country and give their loyalty to the regime. Western sanctions were thus a double failure. They did not wreck the Russian economy or destabilize the elite coalition around the regime. Incredible, isn't it, that the adults came back into the room when the illegitimate Biden administration seized power? And despite their status as very serious intellectuals and the adults in the room, they have proven so spectacularly incompetent that the things they tell us they are going to do that are sure to lead to success not only fail to produce success, they actually backfire. I described the regime situation many moons ago as akin to Chinese finger cuffs. And if you don't know what those are, look them up. But the point is that it seems like it should be really easy to get out of them. And the more you try, the harder it becomes. But back to the article in National Interest. The other set of assumptions was military in nature. Russia's failed use of hard power in the first 2 months of its special military operation was taken as an indicator of gross military incompetence. Claims of high Russian casualties and equipment losses were linked to corruption, poor morale, and disorganization. Most commentators and reporters have accepted at face value the Ukrainian, US, and UK estimates of Russian losses, as well as the equipment loss count of the open source intelligence unit Oryx. The claims of astronomical Russian losses reinforced the long-standing assumption of NATO military superiority over Russia, creating a remarkable war optimism in the West. Ukraine would now use higher caliber Western weapons, tactics, and training to defeat Russia comprehensively. NATO's game-changing wonder weapons were kept on the sidelines and could be introduced when Ukraine needed decisive assistance. These military assumptions have now proven incorrect. The drip-feeding of advanced weaponry, calibrated to avoid crossing Russian red lines too flagrantly, did not allow the Ukrainians to achieve decisive success in 2023. While access to NATO intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance systems has given Ukraine a crucial advantage in battlefield targeting, NATO training, equipment, and planning proved unsuitable for Ukraine's 2023 offensive. And that thing never really happened. It's also important to note that Russia has had all of the Western intelligence the entire time, and the plans for the 2023 spring counteroffensive, which became the spring-summer counteroffensive, which became the summer counteroffensive, which then never really materialized, were posted online. NATO countries have not provided consistent types of weaponry or kept up with the basic needs of munitions production or procurement into 2024. Overall, NATO was not well prepared for the war in Ukraine. Its military doctrines foresaw interventions in civil wars or conflict with weaker opponents, not a proxy war of attrition with a peer competitor. And again, it's important to note that this author is essentially framing this as all of the NATO alliance versus Russia and accepting the now obvious fact that the entirety of the NATO alliance cannot actually go toe-to-toe with Russia, and that's without including any of Russia's allies. In contrast, Russia was better prepared for the long haul of military production and has also successfully innovated in response to the military setbacks it has experienced. The Russian military has adapted to conditions of near total battlefield visibility, the mass use of drones, and the vastly reduced power of tanks and aircraft. This includes innovative infantry assault tactics, new methods of using and countering drones, and more recently, the devastating use of glide bombs that allow Russian air power to be used while evading anti-aircraft fire. On the tactical and operational level, Russia is engaging many parts of the front simultaneously, forcing Ukraine into an exhausting and constant redeployment of troops. Presenting Russian military successes as human wave or meat assaults is clearly inaccurate. Russia's approach is gradual, attritional, and anything but mindless. Given these dynamics, widespread talk of a Ukrainian victory has been replaced by the specter of defeat if the West cannot deliver the needed weapons and supplies. Yet even if the shells arrive in time, Ukraine has a manpower problem that is much harder to solve. The Ukrainian government's deep reluctance to issue another mobilization may reflect a fear of popular discontent and doubts over the state's capacity to deliver the required number of men. And just this week, they announced they were going to lower the conscription age. Now they're claiming the right to go into the homes of any Ukrainians and take any able-bodied men over the age of 25, and they expect to somehow recruit another 500,000 troops. That is farcical and wouldn't matter just based on time anyway. Despite all the above indicators, many in the West want to continue Plan A. More sanctions on Russia, new weapons, more training for Ukraine, all to somehow prepare Ukraine to launch another offensive in 2025. Yet it remains unclear how Ukraine can survive 2024 if Russia is outproducing the West by more than 3-1 in shells and has more troops at its disposal. Something has to give in the next phase of the war. And here it's worth noting that they are trying to get the money, the weapons, and everything else already in process of being sent because Donald Trump is going to be president in 2025. And he has said he will end the war in 24 hours. The current, rather desperate effort to scrape together munitions to ensure Ukraine's immediate survival does not constitute a plan B for the West in Ukraine. A definition of victory is still lacking. It is unclear what prerequisites must be in place for honorable negotiations with Russia. The Western alliance's plan B must be a choice between rapidly developing an effective means of doubling down its support for Ukraine or starting to talk about a compromise with Russia. And again, that's ridiculous. There will be no compromise. Russia is just going to get its way. Nothing could be more obvious than that fact. And it doesn't matter what my opinion of that or your opinion of that is. It is just true. There will be no compromise. Russia clearly has all the leverage. And when you have all the leverage, you do not compromise. Same principle as we were discussing yesterday in the context of these Ron DeSantis supporting neocons and rhinos trying to come back and be MAGA friendly. We have already defeated them. We don't need them. Therefore, there will be no compromise. They have no leverage. But let's continue. Macron's variant of a Western double down in Ukraine looks unconvincing. Talk of NATO troop deployment is not a serious threat to Russia's military dominance. More likely, it represents a signal of Western commitment intended to bolster Ukrainian morale at a crucial time, as well as ensure that, in case of a debacle, Macron himself cannot be accused of having been silent. But in real terms, what could 2,000 French troops do in Ukraine to change the military balance? Surely it would be nothing more than a stopgap, but one with risks of further debacle, given that a NATO contingent in Ukraine would not be protected by Article 5 and would most likely be fair game for Russia's missiles and drones. And Putin has said before, they would be fair game. Statements made in recent weeks do not hold together. Russia cannot be, quote unquote, allowed to win, but the West lacks the means to defeat Russia. The Western alliance lacks the desire or the means to take the initiative in Ukraine. For all the bluster about how the West must not self-deter and cross Russia's red lines without fear, there is no real appetite to engage in brinksmanship over a Russia-NATO war. The lack of realism in Western discourse is clear. There is indeed a serious risk that, rather than the West teaching Russia a lesson and putting Putin in his place, the opposite may occur. Is Russia, in fact, educating the West on what it means to use hard power and wage interstate conflict in 21st century conditions? Russia advertises its version of great power sovereignty, in which a united, resilient, and unwavering state can defeat the pooled sovereignty of the EU and NATO. Of course they can. As soon as anybody challenges the illusory power simply evaporates. And I think at this point, we can assume that the EU and NATO will cease to exist in the relatively near future. We have all heard the objection that Putin simply cannot be trusted, and he wants nothing less than the complete elimination of Ukraine as an independent state. Yet, does not the blind continuation of the West's dysfunctional Plan A also threaten the total physical destruction of Ukraine? It is for this reason that Pope Francis has called on Western leaders not to be, quote, ashamed to negotiate before things get worse. And it's funny that they turn to the Pope to advertise their capitulation in service of peace. He is able to do that as a religious leader, whereas his global regime colleagues, who are political leaders among these global governing bodies or the individual countries that make up the Western alliance or military leaders, all of them would look weak if they immediately came out and said that Ukraine needs to back down for the cause of peace and the preservation of human life. A new approach to the war in Ukraine will not emerge from rhetorical and moralistic proclamations. Words alone will not prevent a Russian victory. What is needed is a clear accounting of what can be realistically achieved with the means available, as well as the costs, risks, and benefits of different scenarios. Trying what has failed before and expecting new results is, after all, not a recipe for success. Now that, in the eyes of people who believe that Ukraine was going to win this whole time, that sounds like a pretty bleak assessment, a very stark portrayal of the reality on the ground. But it seems as though it's actually much, much worse than that for the West. Their power has been challenged and shown to be, if not non-existent, then at least inadequate to contend with adversarial global superpowers. The regime is also currently failing in Israel, and any threat that a situation akin to Russia-Ukraine might happen between China and Taiwan seems to be vanishing because it's getting harder and harder to even take it seriously. The support for Ukraine has vanished. The support for Israel has vanished. In fact, they are trying to drum up another inciting event just to breathe new life into the support behind Israel. It looks like they're preparing to have some sort of event this weekend between Iran and Israel. And of course, we can pray that that doesn't happen in any real way. But that narrative seems like a necessity at this point. Regardless, the whole thing is falling apart. This veil of invincibility that the regime's propaganda media has sold us throughout our lifetimes has been pierced. The idea that all of these other countries will just comply with the global regime and its agenda has become untenable. And as we've discussed multiple times this week now, this is why you simply don't comply on a personal level. You must actually make them follow through with what they say they're going to do and then publicize it to everyone. And there are little cycles of this happening. They have been happening for the last 4 years since the beginning of the very deadly pandemic narrative. Every time their power is challenged, it is shown to be illegitimate, unconstitutional, and wielded with evil intent. But hey, remember to drop your taxes in the mail on Monday. I'll be back on Monday at the same reasonable time on the same reasonable podcast network. I don't have a network. Masks and lockdowns don't work. They lied to you about a pandemic. And Joe Biden will never be president.
In my mind, that's the end game.
If you're listening to this episode for free, you can support me and support the show and the work I do by signing up for a paid subscription at imyourmoderator.substack.com. You can do so for as low as $50 a year or $5 a month. Comes out to under a quarter per episode, and you'll blast right through the paywall for all of the writing. The merch store is www.cancelcouture.com, and you can find everything else by heading to Linktree. Linktree.com/I'm Your Moderator. And I'll see you soon out on the range.
Deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
In my mind, that's the end game.
Thanks for listening. If you'd like to follow what I'm reading and thinking throughout the day, you can do that by downloading the Telegram Messenger app and going to t.me/I'm Your Moderator. On social media, you can follow me on Truth Social, Getter, and Gab at I'm Your Moderator. I also have channels on Rumble and BitChute. If you'd like to follow the writing, you can find me at imyourmoderator.substack.com. The merch site is cancelcouture.com or go direct shop.spreadshirt.com/cancel-couture. If you'd like to support the podcast financially, the best place to do that is Ko-Fi. Go to ko-fi.com/I'm Your Moderator. And all of these details will appear in the show notes with each episode. I'll see you soon down on the range.
It's happening!